Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And today we're catching up with a young lady from Safety Bay Senior High School who's trying to raise some money to go and represent Australian schoolgirls in a football tour in the UK and Ireland. There's also plenty of other sport to talk about, and we look forward to doing that. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm Croaky John Lee.
You are indeed, and congratulations to a Croaky John Lee, because you won your hockey grand final.
We did, the mighty Divvy Four Crabs, came out on top, 4 years of hard work, slog and toil, very proud.
Oh, and so you should be. Some people never get to play in a grand final.
No, and considering the number of people that until 4 years ago had never picked up a hockey stick that we have in our team, it is a mighty achievement.
It is indeed. Well, just while we're talking hockey, I don't know if you've seen Simon Orchard's blog. Again, he's actually sort of written it after returning from the Olympic Games and has basically questioned the elite program with the Kookaburras and possibly the Hockey Roos, saying that they spend so much time now focused on the hockey that there's no time in their lives for anything else. And he feels that there desperately needs to be a balance in their lives, especially if you're going to ask all these people to move to the other side of the country. And I get the feeling you're going to see a really strong push now for the AIS program to be moved back over east.
Well, I don't think it really matters whether you move it east, west, north or south. That's not the problem. Where it is based is not the problem. It's too much hockey seems to be the problem. So whether you're in Perth or not, it's about outlets for the players to do other things. It's not about where you happen to be.
No, I think it is very, very important that they be given that opportunity, because otherwise, you know, you can understand that they would get stale and whatever. And to me, well, you've said before, you felt at the Olympics they looked stale.
Oh, they did. They looked tired. They certainly looked tired. And that happens in any job. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Sometimes people need a break to get away from what they're doing, to clear their heads. And when you're just driven in one thing all the time, you start to lose interest almost after a while. And you're not meaning to. It just becomes so routine and so everyday that you struggle to rise to the occasion.
And I think the other thing, having spoken to a lot of the athletes, and it, let's be fair, it happens in a lot of sports now with athletes at that level, where their social life is also amongst those players. So it makes it, again, that they're almost with them 24/7, and there's no other life away from that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you lose track of what's going on in the real world as well. You don't go to a lot of things because you can't. You've got training, or, you know, you won't go to that party on a Friday night because it means that you're going to take X, Y, and Z or whatever, and you can't do that.
Now, I know people were disappointed, but I look at the Olympic Games and the two hockey tournaments, and when else are you going to see the fifth-ranked team win gold in both tournaments? It was a freakish tournament, and in a way, you'd have to say it was good for the sport because it proved that the top teams are really, really close.
I think in any hockey tournament at that level, top four, if you get to the semi-finals, you've performed well. You've done really well. From there, a fluke goal can change everything. So when you look at the results for the two teams, the men, yeah, probably a little bit disappointing they didn't win one more game. If they had got to the semis, you could have gone, oh, well, that's hockey. For the women, I thought they finished where they should have. And I must admit, I think Rachel Lynch would probably not want to look at that game again, just quietly.
Yeah, I think the women, as you say, I think they probably did perform to where they were at that point in time. And it was disappointing, though, because obviously we want to see Australia in those medal games, in the semi-finals, as you say. So, but that's life. You just got to go on. It's another 4 years now.
And they were beaten by a team that has performed well against them, too. It's not as if Australia has flogged New Zealand, you know, 10-0 the last 10 times they've played them. Far from it. So it's no real surprise, but it is a disappointment.
And if you do want to read about the Kookaburras and their Olympic history, you can actually get the book Australia's Hockey Grail, written by yours truly. I thought I'd get the plug in there for that, John.
It's a good read, though. I will give, mate, you've done a lot of work. It's a fantastic read. For hockey people, you'd love it. Even if you're not really that interested in hockey, but you love your sport, it gives you an understanding of what's really been going on, rather than the once every 4 years Channel Rah-Rah's little spiel about what goes on in hockey.
No, thank you for that. I've actually had some really nice emails from past players, which has really meant a lot to me, saying that they felt it's been a really good reflection on their era when they were playing. And so that's nice. When you get that from people that were there, it means a lot.
Now, it wasn't the only sort of Olympics going on in Rio, was it?
No, well, the Paralympics have just finished. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on that, because to me, it was disappointing the crowds weren't there, but then there were still some fantastic moments in the games, and things that sort of stood out for me, first of all, was I think Zanardi, you know, the Formula F1 driver, winning his gold and silver. And when you saw the BBC's, or sorry, Channel 4, I think it is, Alex Brooker, the comedian from the UK, born with a disability, and then he goes on the show with Adam Hills, The Last Leg, and says how Zanardi, he almost broke down, didn't he? And he talked about how Zanardi was an inspiration for him. And to me, that showed just how important and how inspiring the Paralympics can be, not only to people with disabilities, but also to us who are able-bodied. It proves, the one thing the Paralympics prove is that anything is possible, that you can achieve anything. No hurdle is too great.
Alex's comments were interesting too, from the perspective that he is has a congenital disability. He's born with his disability. He's never known anything but his disability. So to a degree, and we know from talking to disabled athletes, a lot of the time they don't feel that they're disabled because they've never known ability, so to speak. Zanardi, his disabilities come about through accident in racing, as we know, karting. And just to see a guy like Alex say, this guy gives me inspiration. Someone who's known so-called inverted commas normality, and to have that taken away from him and to be doing what he's doing is inspiring me. That, I thought, was a really interesting point.
Well, I think the media outlets have got to wake up to that, to me, and realise that that is the power of these Paralympic Games. You know, and I've attended Paralympic events, and I know exactly what they mean. I mean, there were other people that inspired. I mean, Brant Garvey, who we've had on the show since he took up triathlon. And I just found even he, okay, he didn't medal, but he did his adductor muscle, you know, and yet running on one leg, still managed to finish. And to me, that was a great story, because he said he had to finish because he owed it to all the people that had supported him, and he wanted to finish, and it was important to him. And again, it was inspirational. It was just great to see. And here was a guy that took so long. He tried swimming. He tried wheelchair basketball through Wheelchair Sports WA. And it was another good story.
I also found it interesting, over the years we've talked about Oscar Pistorius when he first came onto the scene and discussing what the blades meant and in the future, etc. We had a situation in one of the races where the top three place getters would have run a gold medal time at the able-bodied Olympics 2 weeks prior. And are we getting now to a point where previously disabled people didn't compete with able people because the able people would smash them. They were always going to run faster, jump higher, whatever it is. But now with the access to the technology that they have, are we going to see that people with a disability aren't going to be allowed to compete with able-bodied people because they'll actually beat them?
Well, that was the concern, wasn't it, when Oscar Pistorius was having his court cases and trying to get the opportunity to race against them. The main reason that the IOC or the International Athletics Federation were against it was they were concerned if athletes were prepared to take drugs in order to win a gold medal, there were athletes out there who, if they got beaten by a man running with blades, that they would take their lower leg off to be able to win that gold. And that was actually, it was never given the publicity, but behind the scenes, that was the major concern. And it may seem crazy to you and I, but the sad thing is there are a lot of people that are that driven, John, that would do that.
Oh, as you pointed out before, you know, they're quite happy to take drugs that could potentially kill them. You know, I don't know how you go about having a limb amputated when you have no reason to have a limb amputated. I don't know how that works, but it could happen.
I mean, I think the other thing that is interesting that you touch on there, and maybe this is the way that the Paralympics and the Olympics are going to evolve, because I know Thomas Bach, who is the president of the IOC, he wants to prolong the Olympics. He also wants to have, so I've been told through sources there, that to have the games integrated so that you may have, for example, for a week it'll be the cycling, the able-bodied cycling, and then they will go to the Paralympic cycling straight after that. And it'll be interesting whether that takes something away from the Paralympics as an event. I know that a lot of people involved in the Paralympic movement don't want to see a merged event, but it's an interesting one.
Well, I think they've got to stay on the coattails of the Olympics. I mean, just from a financial and organisational point of view, I think it would be too much to run them as separate events, far too much for the disabled part of the Olympics to cope with financially.
I question that because I don't 100% agree. I think in Rio, I don't think the Paralympics were a success for a number of reasons, for financial, for the way people with disabilities are treated there. And I wonder if the IPC needs to now look at not necessarily, like at Japan, I think will be a huge success. But I think they need to be very careful about following that if they want the Paralympic Games to be a success. What? Now, you say there's not the infrastructure. There is in a lot of places now, if you look, that there are.
I'm talking not infrastructure for people in wheelchairs. I'm talking infrastructure for broadcasting, for all the facilities that have to go along with, all the staff that have to maintain the facilities, all of those things that when you talk about having the Olympics, you don't really think about until later on. You've got to organise this, you've got to organise this, you've got to organise this.
No, look, I know. I mean, if you look at London, for example, you know, the media centre is now where BT Sports offices are. Obviously, all the accommodation is now people are living in it.
What do you call a successful event?
To me, a successful event is one that obviously you have the ticket sales, you have the support of the public there, you have the TV coverage, and it's the whole thing brought together. Well, it's for the athletes as well, but to me, the athletes are obviously that they're the ones who pull all of that in. Let's be honest; they're the ones that everybody goes to see.
I think what I'm trying to get at is what's the meet for? Is it for having large crowds there, providing content for international or is it so disabled people have an opportunity to compete? And that should be the number one consideration: giving disabled people the opportunity to compete.
Which then kills your argument that we don't need to necessarily have it in a massive venue, because you could have, for example, the athlete. There's athletic stadiums.
You do need to hang on their coattails, because that provides the infrastructure. Okay, to make.
But you just said if we put the athletes first.
But we are putting the athletes first because that infrastructure.
But the infrastructure would be at where you have an international athletics meet, there would be infrastructure there.
Well, what, a running track? Where's the swimming pool?
But a lot of them they would be because they're connected. Not all of them, I admit that.
Where's the cycling track?
John, pool? I know that. I do hear you there.
I think it's, if they cut away, if they try and move away from the main Olympic movement, it's going to cost them a lot more money to run these events, and that money won't be going into the areas that it should be, i.e. the athletes.
Yeah. Well, the IPC announced before the end of the Olympic Games that they were going to lose millions from the Paralympic Games. And they had to go to the Brazilian government and also the mayor of Rio to get them to inject more money because they hadn't met their guarantees that they'd been given. But the IPC, and you wait, they will announce that they have lost a lot of money on the Paralympic Games.
No one will be surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, usually it's the host country and the host city. It's a pity that the Paralympic Committee is going to end up holding a lot of that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Rio and maybe the Brazilian government are going to find that they've made a huge, huge loss as well.
I mean, the issue with the crowds weren't great at the main Olympics either. I mean, I'm not sure the Brazilians fully embraced the Olympic spirit, but... And one more thing on the Paralympics. What is this obsession with the broadcasters having comedians host the Paralympic Games? Now, I like Lawrence Mooney. I watch his TV shows. I listen to him. I read his stuff. I like him. I'd go and see Lawrence Mooney, regardless of what I'm about to say now. But don't put comedians on a Paralympic broadcast. It never works. It doesn't work. You wouldn't show the same level of disrespect to able-bodied athletes. Did you have the guy coming on cracking jokes about the Campbell sisters not winning? No, you didn't. So why does it happen at the Paralympics? I think it's the second or third year on third Paralympics on the trot that they've done this. It doesn't work. Get rid of the comedians.
I agree 100%. I mean, I hated it when the ABC did it. It didn't add anything to the experience. In fact, it was annoying when events were going on that you even had to endure it. Yeah, I don't like it. And I tune in to watch sport, and I want somebody who knows about sport to be introducing it, discussing it, not a comedian. So I'm 100% with you there on that one, John.
Yeah, just bizarre. And I like Lawrence. Lawrence, I hope you do well. Just say no next time they ask.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? If the check's big enough, a lot of people will say yes.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, talking about checks being big enough, our next guest, in fact, our first guest on this podcast, is a young lady from Safety Bay Senior High School, and she's trying to raise money to head over to the UK to play for the Australian schoolgirls as they go on a tour to England, Ireland. I think they're also playing a few games in Wales, but we'll let her tell us all about it, and that is Lucy Jerram. Lucy Jerram, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hello.
Well, obviously you're carving quite a name for yourself in football circles, and I just wondered, what age were you when you started playing football?
Around 5 or 6 years old.
And what was it that got you into the game?
Nothing in particular, actually. Just Mum wanted her children to both be involved in sport. My sister had played netball, but it wasn't really for me, so I just went down to the local club and sort of just, you know, had a bit of a knack for it and enjoyed it. I guess that nothing really in particular, no sort of real large background or whatever, just really enjoyed it from the minute I started playing.
Well, that's the main thing, and I believe you started playing down in sort of Port Kennedy, Rockingham area.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I've only been sort of playing more uptown the last couple of seasons, but always local from a young age.
And what, I mean, the setup, I believe, in the sort of Rockingham, Mandra area is actually very good. They've got some really good coaches. And have they really sort of helped you develop, and did they notice that you had a talent?
Yeah, my school coaches more than anybody, really. The coaches at a club level were sort of just stand-in parents and whatnot that, you know, was just sort of for fun. But when it got to high school and I had a more elite coaches there was where it started to get a bit more serious, whereas it's just always been for fun. While when I was younger, I never really saw it as a big, I don't know if you'd call it a career, but, you know, like a future. Only the past 2 or 3 years has it become very serious.
You mentioned that you've moved to Perth to play your football now, playing in the Women's State Premier League, and you were just 15 when you were doing that. Was that a little bit daunting, or were you fairly confident?
Well, the season before that, I trialled for a state team, and we travelled to Sydney, and there was 3 or 4 girls in that state team that I'd really knitted with and become really good friends with that were already playing at Melville in the Women's State Premier League. So even though there was still a large majority of people there that I didn't know, I sort of had a bit of a foundation with those girls. So it made it a little bit easier, but at 15, the competition and whatnot was just like out of this world. It was the size of some of the people that you're versing and stuff was crazy, but wasn't really much that I hadn't really faced before since I've always been small. So,
but yeah. Do you think being small in those situations, and you read about Maradona and players of his size, that's where, and Messi as well, that's how they learnt their skills, was playing against bigger people and learning how to combat the physicality side?
Yeah, with technique and whatnot. Size isn't always everything, but it does help.
So obviously that's helped you develop. I must ask, obviously travelling from down south up to play for Melville, you must have a good taxi. Is that your mum?
Yeah, that is. Sure is. Yeah, a lot of fuel and time.
Does she make you do lots of work? Sorry, what was that?
I'm starting to pay her back now that I'm driving, but it's only been a couple of months.
Okay, well, that's good to hear that you're paying her back now. Now, the Australian Junior Championships are a major event, and you were lucky to represent WA on three occasions and also captain the side. How did the team go in those tournaments by comparison to the other states?
The first year we came second, which was good considering WA have never really been a team to watch, you know, sort of thing, seen as much of a threat. And then we lost second place last year only to one goal in goal difference count, and then third again this last year, again on goal difference. It's getting better each year. We're becoming more of a threat and not so much a team that people just sort of brush off.
From a personal perspective, the national championships are actually quite important because obviously that's where the national coaches start to identify talent for the future. Is that something you're aware of when you're playing there, or is it just a case of I'm representing WA and I want them to do the best I can?
Yeah, well, there is that, and then also somewhat personal goals that you want to achieve. But when you're out playing and you're with your team and stuff, you don't even think about who's watching and who's there and who you have to impress. You just want to do it for the team, but then also doing your personal best to some, you know, stand out, I guess. But yeah.
What would you say are the strengths in your game?
Speed, I guess, in a way. I used to be a lot quicker than I am now, but still quick, you know, for a winger. Being able to read the play, I think, is something that helps me. Even, like, so, especially in the midfield where you've got to know where you're going and what you're doing before you actually do it, and being able to read what other people are doing as well is something that I think helps and is one of the better qualities that I have.
Are there any areas that coaches have said you need to work on?
Yeah. Confidence with shooting and also headering the ball. I'm terrible at headering the ball. And I know that. I flinch away from it most times, but with practice that will come, I'm sure of it.
I'm sure it will, yeah. I think one of the German players, wasn't it, always used to close his eyes when he headed, and he managed to play internationally. I think it was Oliver Bierhoff. Yeah. Now, the reason we're having a chat is you've been selected for the All-Australian Under-19 Schoolgirls team, and you're going on a tour of the UK and Ireland in January. How did you find out that you'd been selected for that team?
So at the end of the state competition, we have the presentation of the medal awards and stuff, and everyone gets their medals, and then they announce the MVPs of the tournament, and then the All-Australian team is also announced at that ceremony, and you get called up one by one, and you get rewarded with a plaque. But, yeah, so you only find that out at the end of the championship.
And did you see that coming, or was it a nice, pleasant surprise?
Oh, yeah, it was a bit of a surprise, I think. I wasn't very well in one of the games that we played, and also we had a pretty shocking result against New South Wales, which you sort of would think that people wouldn't want to watch, you know what I mean, after that, whereas that was our third game. We still had two more, but, yeah, definitely didn't expect it.
Now, I believe, sadly, although you've been selected for this team, it's not an all-expenses-paid trip, not first-class travel or anything as glamorous as that, and you're actually trying to raise some funds now to cover accommodation and also your kit.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit of a hefty bill, but surely pull it together somehow, doing some fundraising and stuff like that locally. And we have a funding page online as well that people have been contributing to, so that's helped a lot.
Do you know the address of that, and you can give it a bit of a plug?
Yeah, there is a URL of it. It's quite a bit complicated with different letters and whatnot, but I'm sure I could get it to you.
Okay, it's on GoFundMe, isn't it, I think,
yeah, from that's memory. It.
If they go to GoFundMe and then they put in your name, Lucy Jerram, they should be able to find it. Is that right?
Yeah, it's something like that. The Lucy's All-Australian selection is the title of it.
Okay.
On the, GoFundMe.com.
Now, do you know what teams you're going to be playing in the UK and Ireland, or is that going to be announced?
Yeah, we have 10 games over the 21 days that we're there. We start in England against the England Independent Schools. Then the next day it's Bristol City. Then we travel to Wales and we verse the Welsh Colleges. From there we then go to Dublin and verse the Republic of Ireland. And then we go up and versus Northern Ireland. From there, we get a ferry to Belfast, and then we've got George Harriet School Girls, and then another game against England Schools, and then our last match is against Shropshire Schools when we come back to England, and then we sightsee for a little bit, and then we head home.
Fantastic. It sounds a pretty good trip. Now, obviously, women's football in Australia doesn't get the financial support the men's game does, or even some of the support it should get. Does that deter you in any way from maybe looking to pursue a career when you finish school in women's football?
Kind of. Depends where you go. Like, if something was to happen in England, then you wouldn't even think twice about it because it's definitely a lot more supported over there, whereas here it's not quite as seen as fantastic. But there's part-time jobs involved in it and clinics. I know, like, Kai Simon has her own clinics that she does and gets paid well for that, as well as when you get to a higher league, there is money involved, but not as much as the men. But I guess that's a bit of a over-exaggerated amount of money anyway for what they do.
I totally agree with you there. Do you have aspirations to play professionally and obviously for the Matildas, or maybe you even want to play for England? I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Something that I want to happen.
Well, Lucy, we thank you for having a chat with us, especially seeing as you're suffering tonsillitis at the moment. But good to catch up with you, and hopefully you get the funds to get over to the UK and Ireland and have a great tour.
Yes, thank you.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Lucy Jerram, and as I mentioned, she is a student at Safety Bay Senior High School. And if you want to get behind her basically fundraising attempts, just go to GoFundMe and type in Lucy's All-Australian Selection, and you can donate there because she is representing the All-Australian Under-19 Schoolgirls football team on their UK and Ireland tour. And we do wish her all the very best and hope she raises the money. I do find it sad, though, and I know it happens in a lot of sports, not just football, that, you know, okay, they have to maybe raise money for the airfares and accommodation, but then for your own kit, you think if you're representing Australia, surely people supply you with the kit.
Well, they have official kit suppliers, don't they?
Well, the FFA do, yes.
So why aren't they just knocking on their official kit suppliers' door and saying we need, you know, 20 jerseys to fit some girls who are, you know, 6 years old. Go and do it.
Well, there's a lot of questions of over things, as you know, John, that I have with the FFA and the way they do things. It's going to be interesting how things pan out this week because the FIFA and AFC coming down to visit about constitutional issues.
Do you reckon that the FFA might be scrambling a little bit at the moment when the word constitution gets mentioned?
I don't think they're... I honestly think they're that arrogant, I don't think they'll be bothered.
Because, I mean, they're starting to get... There's blokes lining up against the FFA now that have a great deal of power within FIFA and world football.
Yeah, and this is where they've actually, I think, they've been blindsided slightly in that they desperately needed investment in the A-League. So they allowed the Bakeries into Brisbane Roar, the City Football Group into Melbourne, and then the Ledman Group now at Newcastle. And I don't think they realise how connected these people are with the money they've had. So they want their money, but now what they're going to... I think you're going to find that they're going to end up losing is the A-League, in that you are going to see... And we've talked about this on this show for a long, long time, because the AFC said they wanted it by 2017. They pushed it back to 2019, that all national leagues must be run separately from the game's governing body. And I think that's the thing that the FFA are going to find themselves having to do. But the question, and I wrote a piece on the blog, notthefootyshow.com, where does that leave then the state bodies? Because if the A-League clubs are allowed to break away and run their own tournament, what is to stop state league teams, or say the State League First Division or the NPL, breaking away and forming their own division as well and running their own competition? Now, the NPL, supposedly, again, the AFC are here to say they want a second division. Quite how that's going to work, I don't know, because the NPL was put to the AFC and FIFA, or sorry, rather to the AFC, as being the second tier competition. Yet if you look, it's only about a handful of games at the end of the season where the top teams in each state, and this is one of the things, John, that's crazy, is the qualifiers for the NPL playoffs around the country, the qualification in each state is different.
Yeah.
Now you'd think that would be uniform.
You'd think it'd have to be uniform. I mean, we do live in a unified country. I mean,
do we?
We're no longer colonies. You know, 1901 federation and all that sort of stuff. I understand that people might get a bit confused because we've got state education departments and all that sort of stuff. But as far as the national sporting body goes, come on, fellas, get with the program.
Now, I think this is going to pan out. It'll be very interesting what does happen in the next few weeks and what comes out from those meetings.
I mean, I do feel for the FFA in some ways, because we are a unique sporting landscape. We are not Asia. We are not the North America. We're not Europe or Africa. We are completely...
The distances are the biggest issues, and the population.
The distances and the populations. In some ways, we can't run relegation and... type competitions.
They're going to have that forced upon them.
Sooner or later they are, but at the moment it would destroy the competition because there's not enough talent to go around.
I actually disagree with you there, John. I think the competition needs it. Well, the competition is stagnated for the last 3 years.
And
the Central Coast Mariners, and I went back through the last seasons of the NSL, and the NSL, they played more games than they play in the A-League, and yet the bottom team in the last 3 years, and it was the Football Kings, who were pretty useless, they won more games than the Central Coast Mariners last year. The Central Coast Mariners, on their performances last year, no longer deserve to be in the league.
And so who comes up?
Well, the winner of the NPL or whatever. That's what needs to be decided, or they have to have the option.
I don't see that model working at this stage.
I personally don't see that's the ideal thing. I think you need a proper second-tier competition that will then the top team in that goes up, and it's a proper second-tier competition.
And we're still, I mean, football's still proving the finances aren't necessarily there. That's going to be a big killer for them is the money, like all sports.
But I do think that if you look at, again, some of the old NSL teams that were not allowed to come into the A-League, they are still run very, very well.
They are
still profitable, and they're making money. Now, going into the A-League would be tough, but I think that some of those, their business models are actually better than some of the business models of some of the A-League clubs.
Well, I think as well, a lot of the A-League clubs were born from nothing, and some of those other old NSL teams actually have something behind
and
them.
Also illusions of grandeur.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that goes on in
and a lot of ego and a lot of egos, you know.
And that's part of the problem with it, is the ego. And let's face it, FIFA doesn't run football for the health of the game, does it?
It does.
FIFA runs it to protect interests, financial interests. That's what it does. It protects financial interest.
Well, talking of interests, I was stunned to see Ange Postecoglou's comment this week that the European leagues were no better than the A-League. I think Mr. Postecoglou's maybe taken a blow to the head. But the thing is, it's a
He's just talking it up, mate.
But it's a very, very naive comment. Because trust me, what is going to happen now, if there's a non-FIFA date and he wants players, his clubs in Europe are going to turn around and say, no.
Is he just talking to his audience? I mean, is that really going to get back to the European clubs and are they going to care much about what he says?
Trust me, I've already been contacted by people in the UK who've heard of those comments. So, but trust me, Nat, these days those things fly around really quickly. If you diss another competition... But to be fair to Ange, I actually agree with him to a certain extent in that if you look at football now, and we talked about this in the Euros, is there are so many games that are really boring because teams go out there not to lose rather than going out there to win. So I think the point he was making is, look, is some of the games are awful because that is what happens.
I must admit, watching football from time to time and coming from a hockey background, I mean, this football fans seem happy to settle for a draw. A lot of the time you see fans go, we got a point. Got a point. Hang on a sec. You play to win, mate. You don't play to draw.
I must admit, there have been exciting draws that I've watched.
Oh, for sure.
But there are nowadays a lot of very boring draws.
Exciting draws happen when both teams are trying to score goals and win.
Yeah.
When both teams are trying to win, a draw can be exciting. But when one team's just playing 10 men behind the ball and hoping they jag one, that's just rubbish.
And that's where I think hockey's missed a trick, because I think hockey is a far more exciting game. But anyway.
Yeah, at this moment in time, undoubtedly. Because in hockey, you are encouraged to attack all the time. Even the defensive setups, even the teams that are known for, you know, the Germans, etc., and having these big defensive batteries, they attack. They've got great attackers.
Anyway, I believe you wanted to talk about netball.
Oh, yes. Netball pay deal. Netball pay deal. Very interesting. We've seen the West Coast Fever lose four of their players now in the last few days to the new netball franchises. And I just have a worry. It's a great deal for the girls. I'm not taking anything away from them, but I just worry about whether it's too much for the sport at the moment, because these pay deals are being made against projections. There hasn't been nothing like this ever before. There's nothing to weigh up against, to compare against. It's new. So all of these expenditures and financial incomings are all projected. And we know how well projected budgets go, don't we? I just worry that in 5 years' time, if the viewing figures aren't there, the TV stations will turn it off. They'll just turn them off. That'll be the end of it. And I think they've gotten a bit too carried away with sorting the girls out and not sorting the competition out.
Look, I worry because I think TV deals are going to become a thing of the past, because streaming of live sport has already been proved to be the way to go, that people aren't turning on their TVs, they're not turning on pay TV to watch games, that streaming is the way to go. And I think that therefore they're not going to get possibly the financial returns they expect from the TV deals. But my other concern, John, and I've said this before, is I worry about the AFL clubs owning netball clubs, because to me, you know, okay, let's go back a step. The West Coast Fever has always had input from the West Coast Eagles, but their naming was so subtle that I don't think a lot of people would actually realise the Eagles have any stake in the West Coast Fever. But because they used West Coast, everyone, it's West Coast and their Fever and their netballers, has nothing to do with the Eagles, apart from the fact that a lot of the girls date Eagles players or marry them. But the thing that worries me is when times get tough at that AFL club, what's their core business? Their core business will always be the football team. And if money's tight because they haven't got membership or they've got to pay out a fine for doing something or whatever, where are they going to take that money from? They'll take it from netball and they will rob Peter to pay Paul, and Paul being the normal run-of-the-mill business.
Oh, especially you look at a situation like West Coast who have applied and got knocked back for their licence for the Women's Football League, AFL Women. They're going to try for a team in the future, so they'll have the netball team and the women's football team. Now, where do their loyalties lie there?
And will there be parity on the salaries for those players?
Well,
you would hope so.
Well, will it? how many games do you play? And we've talked about this before, you know, all of these players' payment, all player payments and how much money they make in any sport, anywhere on the globe, is all derived from television money. They're not making heaps or this amount of money because they sell lots of batteries or because, you know, they drink Johnny Walker on a television ad. They're making it because it gets shown on television and the television pays the money. And if television doesn't turn up to the party, you ain't got one.
And the other thing that I think everybody's ignoring is, why are the AFL doing this? And the reason is very simple, because they don't have that female demographic in their game. Sure, they've got women go and watch the AFL and sort of are in awe of the guys and the physical specimens that the men are. But what is not there is a women's league for them, which is what they're creating now. If you look in football, cricket, there are women's leagues. In netball, there's a women's league. In all three of the sports I've just mentioned, and we could go hockey as well, there is national representation for women. So there are...
It has been for a long time.
Yeah, and there are moving forward in all of those sports, there is a women's team. Okay, the pay is not the same, but they have women's competitions that run parallel to the men's. And the AFL is, as far as I can work out, one of the few sports in this country that doesn't have that. And they need to get the female, because I know sponsors are turning around and saying, we want to, the female side as well. We want, when we come on board, you can give us the male demographic and you can give us the female. And at the moment, they're going, you don't have the female. We're not interested.
Well, you know, sooner or later, the football girls are going to ask for parity and pay. That's going to be interesting. Do you just say yes to that? I mean, how much government funding is the AFL getting to run these women's programs?
Well, should the AFL get any government
funding? No, well, that's my point, is they shouldn't get a cent.
No, I don't think they should. I mean, when they announce the profits that they are making every year, why is the government giving them a cent?
Well, when they can afford to just go and spend $200-300 million just to set up their own new teams and shaft their own rules to make it happen, you've got to worry about what's going to happen to these other sports. And the AFL won't lie down and let, oh, yeah, look, you guys just go and do that. That's all right. No way will they let that happen.
Well, I think, John, that's probably it for another podcast, but we will be back soon.
Oh, crabs.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is.
See ya. We'll be back next week.